State Government Finance and Veterans Affairs Committee will come to order. Please excuse the tardiness, but we were doing the people's work on our agenda. First item on the agenda today is House File 576, Representative Bonardi. Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Would you like me to proceed, Madam Chair?
Please. Okay. Representative Bonardi, will you please explain your bill?
Okay. Well, first of all, I would like to move my bill, House File 576, for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill.
All right. Please proceed. Present.
Okay. This, I'm working with the Secretary of State's office on this bill because currently the Secretary of State has some challenges in receiving funds that we could get from outside sources to help us, for example, with elections and those sort of things. And when we're outside of session, it's very difficult in the process to get that money coming in, and it actually can delay project. One such project happened with some money receiving to help our elections, and it did not come in time, and it could have enhanced both the primary and the general election, and it did not get in time for the primary election. This has gone through state, it's gone through elections committee, and we've worked with both sides of the aisle on this to make sure that we get the language correct that will be acceptable. We wanted to be sure that it narrowed it in scope and make sure we were really tight on the language just so that we achieved what we wanted to and it wasn't opening it up to other things that we weren't intending it to open up to. So I am going to have Ms. Fraser lead us through the bill to give you a feel for how we've accomplished getting to this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Representative Bonardi explained, the DE2 amendment is changed from the bill as introduced in response to the discussion in the Elections Committee and narrows the scope of the bill. It specifies the circumstances under which the Secretary of State can raise funds, requires that the funds be deposited into a special revenue fund, and requires an annual report on any funds raised. So the bill has two sections, and Section 1 relates...
Just a moment, please.
Okay.
Yeah, do you want me
to...
Representative Bonardi.
Thank you. Madam Chair, would you like me to move my amendment? Thank you. I would like to move Amendment A13-0231.
All right. Ms. Fraser. Do you have it?
I got D2.
No,
you handle it.
Madam Chair, there's a slight difference between the DE2 amendment and the other amendment referenced, and if this is being laid over, we can make that change when it's incorporated into the bill if you want to move forward with the amendment the members have.
All right, Representative Bonardi, would you like to restate your amendment?
Okay, Madam Chair, I apologize for that. I would like to move the DE2 amendment, please.
Okay, Ms. Fraser, will you explain it so that we'll have enough information to vote?
Yes, Madam Chair.
The amendment.
So Section 1 of the bill relates to election projects, and it allows the office to solicit and accept funds from local election officials, basically local governments, for technological projects. This would be of help if there's certain functionality that local jurisdictions feel is important to have added to the state's election systems that we don't have the resources in the state budget to provide or that aren't a high priority at the state level because perhaps they're would only be used by one or two jurisdictions. So this just opens up that ability in case there's a use for it. The second thing it does is it allows the Secretary of State to accept federal funds for elections without going through the Legislative Advisory Committee process. but it only allows that in cases where the funds do not require a maintenance of effort. It doesn't give the secretary the authority to commit the state to continue spending into the future. As Representative Bernardi mentioned, this would have been helpful last, but in the past couple years, we received a federal grant for improvements for military and overseas voters that would have been available to the state in December 2011 based upon federal approval. But because we had to get approval of the Legislative Advisory Committee, we didn't get legislative approval to use the funds until March 2012. So we were able to provide the improvements for military and overseas voters for the general election, but not for the primary because of the delay in the ability to use the funds. The bill also requires that we report annually on any funds raised under this section. Should I move on to the second section? Madam Chair, do you have a question about the first section?
Go on.
Okay. Section 2 of the bill relates to the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program, which the office runs. It's primarily used by, as you'll remember from our office overview, by survivors of domestic violence, but also others who fear for their safety. And this gives the authority to the Secretary of State not to solicit, but to accept funds from individuals if they're offered. There have been times when program participants have been so thankful for the service that they've received that they've said, you know, I just really want to thank you and, you know, I'd like to give you a check for $50 or something. And we'd have to explain, you know, well, there's several forms you need to fill out and then it might go to the general fund, which, you know, wasn't their intent and they have turned out not to give us the money. And so it would allow for that if somebody offers the funds. Again, we don't want to be soliciting those funds. It also gives the office the authority to apply for grants from charitable foundations and for federal grants if they're available. And similar to the previous provision, it would allow us to accept federal funds without going through the Legislative Advisory Committee as long as it doesn't commit the state to an ongoing maintenance of effort. The bill requires that we report annually on any funds raised under this section, and the one difference between this amendment and the one that we had hoped that you would have in front of you is that we want to be sure that if any program participants in Safe at Home do decide to contribute funds, that we're not naming them in a public report, but instead we would say, you know, we received X amount in total from program participants, but not list their names publicly. So that's the one difference between the amendment as it sits before you and as we hope it will be, and I'm happy to answer any questions members may have.
Ms. Fraser, about the fact that the LAC doesn't have to approve anymore.
Yes, Madam Chair.
And that you can just accept these funds, but there has to be an annual report. But when would the Secretary of State then be required to tell the legislature that we got X amount of dollars from whoever we got it from, for whatever purpose?
Madam Chair, the bill requires a report by January 15th of each year to the chair and ranking minority members of the committee with oversight over our finances.
And then the legislature just accepts that report and you go on and spend that money. So you could you have already spent the money before the legislature knows about it? Like if you got the money in June and the election was in November?
Madam Chair, yes, I guess if that were the timing, we could have already spent the funds.
And done whatever, and then we know about it after the fact.
Madam Chair, yes.
Has that been discussed in the other committees?
Madam Chair, the conversation in the Elections Committee was the bill as it was originally drafted didn't specify from exactly what sources we could get the funds, so the conversation was much more about where are you thinking you might get funds from? Let's narrow this and make sure it's very specific to fit the needs and not opening something very wide.
Okay. All right, any other questions? Representative Leidiger.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It just, in the initial reading, it just sends up some red flags on, allowing for dollars to come in at the last minute or within the first few, couple of months of an election, and the legislature, may not know anything about it, and these funds can be expended. Mm-hmm. And I just, have we done this before? Is this is new, if I'm not mistaken, that we would allow your office to accept funds. I just think that this seems very odd to me, the bill. Have we done this before?
Well, they haven't had, the LAC before received notice of the money, if they received money. But Representative Simon.
Well, Representative Leidiger asked a reasonable question. I don't know the answer with respect to the Secretary of State's office, but I do know that we have before authorized contributions, state agencies or others, to accept contributions from the public or from other sources as long as it's narrowly defined. And just to put an exclamation point on what Ms. Fraser was saying, we did discuss this more generally in the Elections Committee. And Section 1 really comes out of this issue of state and county cooperation. There are projects that I think across party lines members here would like to see done in Minnesota, no matter where you are on elections issues, and particularly on election integrity issues, where the Secretary of State would incur a substantial cost, but it would be in the county's interest to chip in if they wanted to. And so this just authorizes that to a greater extent than happens now. Software updates, things like that, to make the statewide voter registration system stronger, for example, when it comes to felons voting, so we can screen that better and more quickly. It might require some money from other sources. And then Section 2 is really only about the Safe at Home program. I think that's what Ms. Fraser was alluding to when she said that sometimes people are really, touched by the program and want to donate, and they really can't. So, but in terms of the guardrails that are in place, Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, in terms of reporting to the legislature, I suppose our recourse, if we see that they got a windfall of some kind, some huge donation, well, that would probably be, to some extent, reflected in our discussions the next legislative session. Not that they would be punished for getting that money, but we might say, well, look, you got $1 million from the counties to do X project, and maybe you don't need quite as much from us. I mean, we could always do that.
Madam,
Ms. Fraser,
Chair, and Representative Leidiger, and members, we are. I don't know if other agencies have had this sort of language. I know that the office under the previous administration ran a task force on electronic real estate recording, and that there was very broad language to allow that task force to solicit and accept funds to fund their projects. In terms of the federal grants, in the time that I've been with the Secretary of State, so just over 6 years, there have been two grant opportunities, I believe, and at least two that we applied for and received grants. And so it's not that they come around all the time, and if you don't believe this timing works, we'd be happy to do a report to if we're applying for a grant or something. What we want to avoid is the situation that we had last year where there was a 3.5-month delay in the ability to use the funds, which then delayed us in providing the services, in this case to military and overseas voters, because we weren't able to begin using the funds or doing the work until we received authority to do so.
Madam Chair.
Representative Leidig.
That was a federal grant that was applied for, and then dollars came in. And they, you could have expended those right away, if I'm not mistaken.
Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, we were not allowed to expend those until we got approval or until the Legislative Advisory Committee decided not to object. And that took 3.5 months. So we had the federal government's permission as of December 2011 to begin the work and had to wait until late March 2012 to actually begin the work. So that's the period that we're trying to avoid in future elections and, you know, wanting to be able to provide services to voters in a timely way.
Representative Leidiger.
Well, and just to be frank, I mean, that's not the... that's not really the piece of this that I object to. I understand the federal side of it. It is opening it up, where the red flags come in, is opening it up to the solicitation of any funds across the board and those coming in and no one knowing about it. You know, the federal grants, we all understand. I mean, you've applied for those dollars. They're going to come in. We know that they will be expended. I think what this bill then covers is it just expands it to other groups. I think that's where I have the concern.
And Madam...
Thank you. Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair and Representative Leidiger, this bill is much narrower than it was and it is introduced, and I hear you saying maybe it's not narrow enough, but it only allows us to solicit... funds from local election officials, and if there are projects that they would like to see us work on that we don't necessarily have the resources to do otherwise. So it has been narrowed. It does not allow us to take funds from the Chamber of Commerce or, you know, Take Action Minnesota or, you know, nonprofit groups or anyone
else.
Fraser.
Representative Bernardo, we're going to give Ms. Melander a pop quiz. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Representative Madam Chair, I would like to, is okay at this time to withdraw my DE2 amendment and offer my other amendment?
Yes.
Okay, I'd like to withdraw DE2 amendment and offer A13-0231. Move that one.
Representative Bernardi has withdrawn DE2 and is offering 0231 amendment. Discussion continued. There's just one online, page 2.6. That's the difference between the two amendments. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Fraser, I heard this correctly and some of the concern about spending the money while we're not in session. The money you would get, if you were to get money, there would be something that would commit the Secretary of State for a long-term project. That would not be able to be spent. This is only for projects that are limited in scope and for a specific purpose.
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, yes, the bill is crafted so that sometimes if federal funds are offered, it commits the state to continue spending at the same level into the future. That was the commitment made by the state for the Help America Vote Act funds back in 2003-04. This does not allow the Secretary to make that commitment. In that case, it would still go through the normal process. It only allows us to receive federal funds without going through the LAC process if there are not strings like that attached.
So no tails.
Yes.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Fraser, three quick questions. One was from a statement that you made in terms of my clarification regarding you can't accept donations from the chamber or the Take Action and so on. But I'm looking in Section 2, and funds contributed by individuals and may apply for grants from charitable foundations. Help me understand why a member of the chamber couldn't be one of those people.
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, so Section 2 relates only to the Safe at Home Address Confidentiality Program.
Okay.
And so an individual who is a member of an organization could, of course, be an individual who would choose to contribute.
Okay.
And or if an organization had a charitable foundation, they could choose to contribute. But again, this is limited to the Safe at Home program.
Okay, and thank you for that clarification, Madam Chair. The idea of a solicitation, could that be construed? My follow-up question to that, have you had counties actually say, wow, we sure wish we could give you some money so you could do this for us? My question to you is, could the Secretary of State come up with a model for a poll book, for example, and the solicitation is more of a bill? So I'm just trying to get my head around the scope of solicitation. Could it be, in fact, we need to do this, so we're going to do this and we're going to bill the counties rather than the county coming to you and say, we'd sure like to do this and we'd be willing to donate money?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, we do not have any authority to compel local jurisdictions to give us funds or to bill them. I think that we work collaboratively with local election officials and are often in discussion with them about, wow, we wish the system could do X, Y, or Z, or it would be much more efficient to us if you added this functionality. And there could be a situation where we would say, you know, we thought we might add this functionality. What do you think? In which case they would then say, well, we'd love that. You know, we would help pay for that. But there's no... So, but it would always be up to the local jurisdiction whether or not to give the funds. Without a bill passed by you all, there's no authority for us to impose a fee or require that they pay us for anything.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Benson.
And that was, in fact, the reason I asked the question, because we are going to pass some legislation to get it on a record that this isn't going to compel someone by vis-a-vis this solicitation that it is, in fact, a bill. But have you had any counties? Can you just address, have you had counties come and say, wow, we sure wish... I find that a little strange because they're usually always asking us for money. But nevertheless, have you had counties come to you and say, we'd like to donate to your cause to help us?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair and Representative Benson, I don't think we've ever had any county say, wow, we really want to give you money. You know, it's just laying here or something. But, I mean, we have had conversations. County auditors use the statewide voter registration system every single day. They are entirely dependent upon that system. All voter registrations are entered into the system. Absentee ballots are processed in the system. So we're in constant conversation with them about ways that we could change the system to streamline processes or things that would save them funds. There are also examples of things that... And there haven't been conversations, so I'm just brainstorming, just to be clear. But so, for example, our reporting system, our results reporting system, only reports results from regular elections. Well, we now have a few jurisdictions that run ranked choice elections, and we can't report those results. Theoretically, and again, this conversation has not happened, I'm just brainstorming, but, you know, theoretically, a jurisdiction could say, you know, we really wish your reporting system could report these type of results. And we would say, well, it's not really a good use of state funds because there's only a few that use that. And if they wanted results reported enough, they might say, well, what if we paid you to do that? I mean, just in theory. And I know that some people don't support that system, so that may have been a bad example. But I'm just trying to think of, you know, something that where they might want to do that.
We're going to field. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And... the language that we're discussing here about the gifts and that, I mean, that appears a lot of places in statute. I mean, in Section 3D.20 under the Sunset Act, there's the commission may accept gifts, grants, donations from any organization. We heard a bill earlier this morning in the Government Operations Committee basically recodifying the LCC's authority in their bill. They've also got gifts, being able to accept gifts. We do this a lot in different places in legislation, so it's not that out of the norm of what we do in legislature. And the language, actually, this language is tighter than what other, like 3D says. 3Ds, they can use it for the act of the commission. They're tied here by saying if it's for a short period of time. So I don't think this is that far out of field from what we've done in the past.
Representative Bernardi moves adoption of Amendment 231. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Bernardi.
Madam Chair, I just hope that this gets unanimous support that it got out of the Elections Committee, and I've appreciated working with both sides of the aisle to getting this into a bill that we all can support. So I appreciate your support today. Thank you.
Representative Bernardi renews her motion that House File 576 as amended will be laid over. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative Simon, House File 253. Welcome, Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this will just be laid over, right, for possible inclusion. Is that the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Do you seek a formal motion? Okay. Then I'll move that House File 253 be laid over for possible inclusion.
All right. Representative Benson. You have an amendment, or Representative Simon, you have an amendment?
No, there's I'm an sorry. Amendment. there is an amendment. It's not my amendment. Why don't I explain, if it okay. pleases the chair, why don't I explain the bill, and then we can go to, is it Representative Benson's?
We amendment? Can do okay. it that way.
And I think that the testifier here is in a much better position, and you probably know that the gist of the bill is to basically create a state auditor enterprise fund, and there's some reasons for doing that that would be a benefit to the state. It would simply take this out of the general fund and create a special fund. So I'd rather have the testifier explain the ins and outs and the reason for doing this and the reason for why we're doing it now or proposing to do it.
Mr. Lindemann.
Hi. Matt Lindemann, Office of State Auditor. So this bill would remove the audit practice portion of the State Auditor's Office from the general fund and create an enterprise fund to track the revenues and expenditures. So the benefits we feel that this would have would be they would allow the revenues and expenditures to be tracked together. Currently, the revenues come in as non-dedicated receipts, and at times it's very difficult to explain the relationship between the revenues and expenditures and present that in budget when we're presenting our budget. It would reduce the general fund appropriation. There would be a small benefit to cities and counties that are audited by the State Auditor's Office because it would help stabilize audit rates. Currently, we have to submit our audit rates to Minnesota Management and Budget for approval. We're required to recover all our audit costs, which when calculating what our rate should be, can result in us over-recovering, and then those revenues are retained by the general fund. This will allow us to take those into consideration when determining our audit rates in the future. So those are the primary benefits this bill would have.
Representative Kahn.
Well, this used to be how the State Auditor's Office was set up, and I was the person responsible for putting it into the general fund as we decided to that the best way to control state expenses was to all have them in one place. It was also done after a former state auditor and former governor later, Arnie Carlson, used this fund for extensive renovation expenses in his office. And that was when we decided this should operate the way any other funds do in terms of getting an appropriate telling us the estimate of what you want for an appropriation, getting an appropriation, and then moving it in and out. It was a year that we actually put a lot of special funds into the general fund, received special commendation for doing this, and of course over the years I've watched them all move back into special funds as people don't like the extra a bit of control that being in and supervision that being in the general fund entails. So how do you answer this argument and this piece of history?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair.
There's only one egregious auditor and no one will ever do that again, but that egregious auditor got to be governor. So I you know, that might just set a path for people.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, we don't feel that this would change the oversight this committee or the state would have over these funds. We would still be required to have MMB approve our audit rates. We would still be audited by the legislative auditor, which we currently are done. And we would still bring back these expenditures and revenues back to this committee and to other committees we report to explain how we have spent our funds, what we have collected, and what we have spent.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I assume that was done in the previous situation, otherwise we never would have found out about it. So what is in here to say that renovating, when you're moving into new offices, renovating them, including building showers and so forth, which I generally approve of state government doing, is not an appropriate use of the audit funds?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I think the statute requires us to recover audit costs. I don't think building a shower would be really considered an audit cost, so it would not be included in the funds of what we'd calculate as part of our recovery.
Unless you wanted to clean up the spreadsheet. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple questions for backgrounding for the committee, if I could. Does the auditor's office have the ability to levy fines against individuals that they oversee or reports that they audit?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative Driscoll, we don't have that ability. We have our strictly what we have the ability to do is audit the local government and report on what we find.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there would be no built-in incentive then in this, if you will, to, using Representative Kahn's example, for short on money to build showers, let's levy a few more fines or charge a few more independent fees or other kinds of things to generate additional revenue into the auditor's funds or into the auditor income side of the balance sheet, P&L.
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative, I yes, that's true. Thank you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have an A1 amendment that should be in your packet, and Representative Simon can probably remember this from a couple of years ago. I don't think we changed a word in it. The situation, however, has changed, so I'm hoping that the author will see this as a friendly amendment, given the complete change in circumstances. Currently, the auditor can entertain. There's a process for it, and I think it's 2 years out. They have to make application, and the application is considered from a local entity, a county, for example. And you can jump in and help me with this if I make a mistake. I think I have it right. And they become part of a process to look at whether or not they want to go. If they're currently being audited, by the auditor, if they want to use an outside contractor, or if they are a county who currently uses an outside CPA firm, an auditing firm, they need to request that they can come into the audit so that you can balance your workload and the like. Nod your head if you think I'm right so far. To the testifier,
Mr. Lindemann.
Lindemann.
Not don't translate.
Okay, yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I believe it's a 3-year cycle that we work
3-year.
On.
3-year, okay. Thank you, Mr. Lindemann. I appreciate that. One of the concerns that I have, of course, is that with the money being in the general fund and we having to allocate, this really wasn't a profit center as such. I mean, because it was either you had plenty of money because we were very generous, or if there was maybe not enough, or we held you pretty tight because there wasn't quite as much. But I see a little less control over that from the general fund, and less of an incentive to say if somebody just makes that appeal, hey, we don't like your audit rates, we think we can shop around and do better, or we're not satisfied with the work. And I'm not saying they're saying that in droves. But I do have a concern that as a profit center more now, that it will be a little less likely that if somebody comes to make that appeal that they're going to get approval for moving out of the auditor's audits and into an arrangement with a private firm. That's the emphasis for the amendment, and it offers some surety, some guarantees to folks. And I'm not saying they're going to take advantage of it, but it offers a little bit more guarantees that if they do want to do that, they'll be able to do that. And it's all one of those customer service kinds of things. If the auditor does a fantastic job, the rates are great. Never have to worry about anybody even thinking about applying for it. But this would put it in statute that gives them that avenue to do that. And this is kind of an explanation of the bill and the reasoning behind it. And ma'am, I once we get to it, I'd like to call a roll call on this. On this bill.
On the bill or the amendment?
On the amendment.
Yeah. Representative Simon.
Thank you. Representative Benson, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I oppose the amendment, as does the auditor's office. I think that I understand where you're going, and we had the discussions, those of us on this committee, last term. I don't see the need for the expanded authority when it comes to the private CPAs. Incidentally, I understand that this amendment didn't come from the CPAs. I was told that before this hearing. I know it's sort of something you've done, Representative Benson. But I'd be very careful, members, about tinkering with the authority that exists right now. And I'm hoping if I could defer to Mr. Lindemann to discuss why this is ill-advised right now.
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I don't think it's fair to characterize the Audit Practice Division as a profit center, since we only collect revenues that balance with our expenditures. So what the state auditor has told me that she strongly opposes this amendment because it would hamper the office's ability to oversee over $20 billion in spending by local governments in Minnesota each year. So.
Madam Chair. Thank you. Representative Benson.
Maybe elaborate a little bit more on how that last. I mean, foregone if the author doesn't approve of the amendment, it's probably not going anywhere. But for the record, how that last statement you made in terms of what the auditor said, how would this do that, given the fact that county governments still have to be responsible to their constituents, and this is just allowing for an outside auditing firm to do the same work that the auditor's office would do? So how... How does what you said comport with the reality there?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, it's kind of hard to characterize, but that's the message the state auditor would like to convey, is that this would hamper our ability to have that oversight. The authority to choose which audits need to be audited and which ones don't, I believe, is the real gist of the difference. If we don't have the authority to choose which ones we should audit, it really does make it hard for us to balance our workload. It makes it difficult to go in and audit an entity that really needs to be audited and make those decisions and let professional staff in our office make those decisions.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I think one analogy, although it's not quite apples to apples, that I would make too for members of this committee is the legislative auditor. I don't think Mr. Nobles is here, or anyone from his office, not that I see, but, you know, were we to, for example, say that a lot of the work that the legislative auditor could do could be farmed out or outsourced or privatized, I think we on this committee might say, look, we want to retain that authority, at least. We want to retain the authority to ask a central person accountable to us. He is the legislative auditor, someone who technically we and the Legislative Audit Commission could hire or fire. We would want to retain that authority. It's not that no one else could do the physical work as well. I mean, that's certainly possible. But I think retaining the authority and the oversight is an important function here.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm seeing this as a somewhat of a privatization amendment. And I have a question for about this, and it maybe wouldn't necessarily be Representative Simon, maybe it's Representative Benson, but would this allow this to be outsourcing and to other countries to be able to do this work with this amendment that's being put in?
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, this would allow for the local government entity to decide how they wanted their audit conducted. So I suppose you could you could extrapolate from that that they could go to China, but I doubt it. you know, in fact, all it really is they already do have the ability to do this. This just puts it in statute a more clear path if they so choose. You know, right now we just heard if they should decide that they want to go through this process of outsourcing, if you will, or privatization, not go through the state auditor and use another private firm to do this. If they wanted to do it right now, if they decided they wanted to do that, they couldn't do it until 2016 because of the rule that we have now that it takes about a 3-year cycle in order for them to equalize their workload.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to go back to the testimony we got from the state auditor in this committee. And if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong, aren't there a number of entities currently that get outside auditors today and send that report to the auditor?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, the state auditor audits approximately 59 or 60 counties, leaving the remainder of the 87 being audited by other CPA firms.
Representative Howe.
So if we pass this amendment, that just gives the rest of those 37 or how many ever you said that actually gets done by the auditor the option to do what the rest of the 87 counties are currently doing. I don't see where the ramifications of that actually come true. If it's good for the rest of those 87 counties, and I would think that it would give you actually more time to, if you suspect that there's a problem with one of those audits that have been conducted by a professional CPA firm, that you could actually have more time to spend some time and delve into the particulars of those that have already been conducted by someone else. So I guess I'm struggling with, if it's good for those other rest of those 87, why isn't it good for the ones that you choose to do?
Representative?
Was that question? Yes.
Yeah, that's my question. I guess if it's good for those other 87 counties, why isn't it good the rest of those? How come it's not good for those that you conduct, and would it not give you more time to get more into the weeds, so to say, with those audits?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the difference is that currently the state auditor has the ability to look at the circumstances and make a choice which ones are appropriate for her to audit, whereas under this bill, she would not have that authority. So we are the state auditor would like to retain her oversight authority to make those decisions based on the professional skills that are within our office.
Representative Howe.
Madam Chair, she would have more. The auditor would have more ability to actually choose to do more because she wouldn't. She could still choose any one of those audits to look at, could she not? I mean, it doesn't preclude her from those audits, from those other ones that get done by someone else. Does she not have the ability to look at those again?
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, I'm not currently the way the office functions is we do a desk review of those, but we don't do an in-depth. A lot is discovered when you're doing an in-depth audit, when you're doing the financial statements and looking at the actual transactions. So there's a big difference between just kind of an overview and doing an actual audit.
Roll call has been asked for. Ms. Melander?
Representative Murphy?
No.
Representative Detmer?
Yes. Yes.
Representative Benson?
Yes.
Representative Bernardi?
No.
Representative Dean?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Howe?
Yes.
Representative Kahn?
No.
Representative Krasha?
Yes.
Representative Leidiger?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
No.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Yes.
Representative Purcell?
No.
Representative Swatsky?
No.
Representative Simon?
No.
Representative Wills? 7 ayes and 9 nays.
The motion does not prevail. Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, that really is the bill. I think folks generally understand it. I know it's being laid over, so we're not taking a vote, but thanks for your time and attention.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Lindemann. Representative Simon, House File 279, Jobs Z and Business Subsidy Agreement Audit Requirements Modified.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill, and I don't know if there's someone here from the Legislative Auditor's Office, this bill merely says that there are functions right now within the Office of State Auditor that ought to be in the purview of the Legislative Auditor, and both agree. One has to do with Job Z, which members may know sunsets anyway in 2 years, so it's not going to be relevant for long. And then the second has to do with a Dairy Research, Teaching, and Consumer Education Authority. And both of those were somehow put in the State Auditor's lap when really they belong in Mr. Nobles' lap. And as I say, both agree. There's no conflict. They both agree that's where they should be. So this basically moves that authority from the State Auditor to the Legislative Auditor. So that is it. And I understand, Madam Chair, we don't formally and technically, I think, have this bill before us, but it's important that it at least be heard, the language be heard, so that at some point in time it might be included in an omnibus bill. So I don't know if members have questions or concerns.
Anybody have questions about the concept?
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Is this bill going into the state government finance bill, or is it going, what did that comment about we don't have formal?
They're trying to work on some other language, and we don't have the bill.
Right.
Representative Freeberg.
You know, we heard this in government operations, I think, and passed it along to the General Register.
Right. Also. Yes.
Oh.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay.
It's on the General Register, but it was important that at least we take up the language here so that if it does end up in an omnibus, no one can claim that members of this committee were ambushed. Basically.
And Representative Kahn, you certainly recognize the value of having a bill heard in many places.
Right, but we usually didn't need to have formal bills. We just put the language in wherever we felt. No. We do it.
Any other comments? We have heard it, Representative Simon.
Okay.
Representative Purcell, House File 651.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell.
Could I move 651 for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill?
Okay. And what is 651 all about, Representative Purcell?
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House File 651 is about updating of accounting system for cities and townships, and I have with me two gentlemen that can provide clarity to the bill language. Can read. This is a bill brought to me by the auditor and the Association of Townships and League of Cities and Small Cities, and they have requested that we move in this direction so that they can improve their accounting systems. And I don't know who to ask first. Mr. Ken Sulem is here from Minnesota Association of Townships.
Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Sulem, General Counsel with the Minnesota Association of Townships. House File 651 is a bill that we have been working with the State Auditor's Office on, along with the city associations. CTAS is the accounting software that approximately 1,000 townships and 300 small cities use to keep track of their finances and to be able to do automatic reporting to the State Auditor's Office. It is by far the most efficient and effective way for our members to do their accounting. It's not a mandate, but it is every year more and more members are joining the use of the software because it's cheaper and directly tailored to our reporting needs than any other program that's on the market. However, after 20-some years of life, it's at the end of its useful cycle in terms of the technology and needs to be rewritten into modern computer platform language. I'm not a technology expert, but it needs to be redone so it can work with today's operating systems. And the estimated cost of that will be about $250,000. And rather than trying to fight for general appropriations that are very hard to come by, we have worked out an arrangement with the Auditor's Office whereby, after consulting with us and the Small Cities and League of Cities, the auditors will set a one-time fee. It'll be charged as a user fee at the time of acquisition of the software. The first amount of the money will pay for the upgrade and rewrite that is necessary. All surplus funds and additional user fees will go into a dedicated account. As you see in Section C, that dedicated account can only be used for maintaining and upgrading the CTAS program. So some of the other issues that were being asked can't be used for any of those other purposes. It's very focused what it can be used for. And if at any time this program ceases to exist, whether it's because we decide there is better software out there, a future auditor no longer supports the program, whatever the cause, the money will be, again, after consultation with the state associations, refunded back to the contributing members. So we would ask your full support for House File 651.
Mr. Lindemann.
Madam Chair, I really don't have anything to add to it. I think Mr. Sulem did a great job.
Any questions? If not, Representative Purcell renews his motion that House File 88 be laid over.
88 or
651? I mean, 651 will be laid over.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
I was so anxious to get to Representative Detmer. Yes. Representative Detmer.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members.
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, this House File 88 has already been heard in Representative Paymar's public safety and finance policy. It was referred to the General Register, and it's made a U-turn back to our committee here. So we'd like to hear it in our committee, and thank you for hearing the House File 88.
You're welcome.
Quickly, this bill will allow a person to use a certified copy of his or her most recent honorable discharge. And the forms we use in the military is the DD-214, and from the military to issue a after conviction of a crime that would otherwise disqualify the person from public employment or a position. And we take a look at this type of legislation, this is in addition to the current statute 364, which relates to rehabilitation of criminal offenders. And in 1974, the Minnesota State Legislature first recognized that criminal offenders should have the ability to be rehabilitated themselves and become productive members of our society. And I know the military is pretty strict in allowing who can get into the military today. And it wasn't like in the old days where you either go in the military or go to jail. That's not the case anymore. And what this bill simply does is that allows someone who has served honorably in the military coming out that they can use their DD-214, the most recent one, when they are applying for employment. It does not give them an advantage or anything like that. It just allows them to have another document in hand when they're applying for jobs. And I have Trista Mattis Castile to talk about the bill also.
Ms. Mattis Castile.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I feel like I've you've seen a lot of me recently as the chair of the Women Veterans, working on other legislation for veterans. But today I'm here to share a personal story and how this bill realistically can apply to veterans. In 2003, when I was leaving the Marine Corps and joining the Minnesota Army National Guard, I joined a unit and was to be trained to be an officer and go to officer candidate school. There was a young staff sergeant that was put in charge of us 12 to-be lieutenants and train us on how to become not only officers in the United States Army, but also to get ready to lead men and women to combat. This young staff sergeant had trained many. He had served in the Ranger Regiment for 16 years. He had 13 combat deployments in 57 countries. He was well qualified to train all of us. And at that time, I had already served in the Marine Corps and the Navy for 12 years. And I can tell you, he was the finest non-commissioned officer I had ever met and did a great job. All 12 of us that he trained not only graduated officer candidate school, but I was the distinguished honor graduate, and every other one of my peers were the honor graduates of their platoons or companies, respectively. He did a fine job. Just after we all graduated and went off to our officer basic school, this staff sergeant returned on one final mission. He found himself on a cold, snowy night, January 24th, 2004, in an armed standoff. Only this time, instead of closing with and destroying the enemy, he was in an armed standoff with 8 Lakeville police officers on his front yard in Lakeville, Minnesota. He was in a dissociative state and believed he was in a different place in a different time. Now, luckily, the outcome was good. The police officers, one of whom was also a veteran on site, recognized that he was a veteran, and the way he was acting showed that he was a veteran, so they didn't kill him. And all rights they probably should have by their normal protocol, but one police officer recognized it was a veteran, and they were able to de-escalate that situation. That staff sergeant still maintained his duty in the Minnesota National Guard. He went through lots of counseling and therapy, anger management, and the whole realm of, the things that court ordered him to do, and did it all well. He was promoted, not once, but 2 more times to the rank of first sergeant and sent back to Iraq to lead a company into combat 1 more time. That staff sergeant's now my husband, Hector. Excuse me. And since leaving the Army, after 18 years of service, 14 combat tours, he is now a licensed clinical social worker who does therapy for men and women, both veterans, police officers, and families on areas of trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. This bill won't help Hector, but I can tell you that this bill will help many veterans like him. It has been a constant struggle for the last 9 years for him. Every time he's applied to go to school, applied for a job, applied for a licensure, because not only does he have to explain what happened, but he has to relive those moments that brought him to his post-traumatic stress in order to explain that he has indeed rehabilitated and that he has moved on and contributed to society. He now runs the Chain Step program with the Domestic Abuse Partnership. He leads groups of men who are offenders and domestic abusers to rehabilitate them as well and to return to family life in a positive, healthy relationship. So Hector has succeeded and fought uphill. I can tell you personally it's been a constant battle for our family and a constant stress to have to relive the event of 2004. But in the future, if we pass this bill, other veterans who may have had similar experiences, or hopefully ones not quite as traumatic, can use their positive honorable discharge and their DD-214 so that they can move forward and contribute to society, get jobs, without having to relive the events that brought them to that point. Thank you.
Representative Dentmar, give me a time frame that this bill would allow from that. When the person was breaking the law to the time that they're using their DD-214.
Madam Chair and committee members, House File 88 would only apply for any crimes committed before entering the military, not after that point. And also, there's a clause in the bill that the bill adds a section, a statute that would honorably discharge ceases to qualify as evidence of rehabilitation for any felony crime convicted where the crime was committed after the effective date of the discharge. So the key thing is that we use the last effective, the most recent DD-214 as they leave the military. And again, this legislation will not give anybody a heads up or just maybe a hands up to allow them to use that honorable discharge when they apply for employment.
But okay, and then Ms. Mata Castillo, when the person in your story met the Lakeville police and then was rehabilitated,
right.
Did the Lakeville police charge him?
Yes, ma'am.
Madam Chair. And then what happened? And then?
Yes, let me explain. The one small, Representative Dentmar just slightly misspoke, and I'll just correct that.
Okay.
This bill could be used, or the honorable discharge can be used, as long as the honorable discharge has happened since the event of the crime. So in my story of my husband, he was still serving when it occurred. He was charged with a gross misdemeanor, which is why he has to show rehabilitation. And so he would, if this bill had already been passed, he would have been able to use his DD-214 to go to college to get his licensure as proof of that, as opposed to always going in front of a board telling his story and numerous documents to prove rehabilitation. It would just be a menu item of something in addition to prove rehabilitation. So the correction is that the DD-214 is only valid if the crime occurred prior to receiving an honorable discharge. So I'll give another example. Sometimes we have young folks, and I know Representative Howe can speak to this as a commander, we have young folks who are joining the military that get a waiver to enter the military. Typically those waivers are for underage drinking. So someone's 18 years old, they get charged with underage drinking and they want to join the military. They might serve 20 years, 10 years, 5 years honorably, and now they're old enough to get jobs. We see a lot of veterans not able to get jobs all the way back from that underage drinking despite their honorable service in the military, which clearly it was just a cause of growing up a little bit. And now they can't become police officers, they can't work in Department of Human Services because that previous conviction takes them off limit, where this DD-214 can be used to prove rehabilitation. So my husband's case is an extreme case, but it also would affect those more minor cases as well.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howe. Okay. No. Or Freeberg, I'm sorry.
Sure. I just noticed on line 1.8, it speaks about public employment. Does this apply only in cases involving public employment or where a license is sought?
Madam Chair, yes.
And I noticed also on line 1.12, Madam Chair, it says competent evidence may be established. Is it the supervisor or they this gives them the authority to use the DD-214, but it doesn't require them to use it, so they would still have the discretion to deny it, I guess, on that basis? Is that?
Madam Chair and Representative, yeah. What it does, it just allows another document to be used when applying for a job. They don't have to, but it would allow them.
Representative Detmer, you did say that this bill was heard in public safety.
Public safety, and
then
referred
passed out. With
passed
recommendation
out.
To pass.
That's correct, ma'am.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author or to Ms. Mata-Castillo, as I'm reading this, so without this new language, the statute as is right now says that the person, in order to show evidence of rehabilitation, has to show on line 1.18, one, they must show a copy of the release order, and either two or three, those other things listed there. Mm-hmm. It seems to me because of the structure of this, because you didn't add a four, you didn't say it has to be the release over or two or three, or you could have said four, the honorable discharge. Instead, the way that you structured it as I read it is now it's a two-track approach. Either they show the DD-214 and that ends the inquiry completely. They don't have to do anything else, just that, not even the release order. Or, at the end of line 1.17, this other thing. Or, so if you don't have a DD-214, never served in the military at all, then you have to go through this other stuff. I guess my only worry about that, and I know public safety heard it. I'm on public safety, and I must have stepped out at that point because I just don't remember hearing this particular bill. That's not my fault, not yours. But I wonder why you structured it that way. I mean, by definition, this committee is full of people who have great respect for our veterans, and we process many bills here to help our veterans in many ways. But to me personally, the way this is structured puts the thumb on the scale a little bit too much in favor of a veteran. And by that I mean the way this is structured, and it may not have been your intent, that's why I asked it, is under this bill, it's case closed DD-214, and everyone else has to at least show a release order. And then this other stuff. So a veteran, as opposed to someone else who was not in the military, has to jump through quite a few more hoops. I mean, I like the language. I think that someone who has been honorably discharged from the United States military is entitled to at least a presumption of fitness here, absolutely. But the structure does matter to me because the way it's written, I've said too many words. What I'm trying to say is I would prefer to see this new language on page one added as a number four among the list that other people in society have to produce rather than what here seems like a totally separate track. It's DD-214, case closed. And everyone else at least has to show a release order. What do you think about that? I mean, would you be open to that?
Ms. Mata-Castillo.
Madam Chair, Representative Simon, so the reason why we have it listed this way is that in order to get an honorable discharge, you've already shown all that stuff. And I can assure you that the military is more thorough even. If you get that honorable discharge, you've already shown all that. And so it's to prevent duplication. So they've already shown it. In order to enlist, they've shown that release. If they're serving and the crime attends, I can assure you, with all of the extra stringents and rules in the military, they've already proven it. So it's just a matter of not having to do it for a second time or a third or fourth. And so the way it's written is the way we prefer it.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, thanks. I didn't know that. That's
good point.
Why I asked
good
the question. And so, and I see head nods from nonpartisan staff. So if that's the case, then that certainly satisfies my question.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Mata-Castillo, congratulations to your husband on his LICSW. My partner has an LICSW as well. My question relates to the public portion and the issue around the restrictions within DHS for individuals that have criminal records. Is this a blanket change to allow them for all positions that would have restrictions with a criminal record, or are there some exceptions that would be carved out by this?
Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, Representative Den.
Matta Castillo.
Yes, ma'am. So my husband actually works full-time for the Department of Human Services now, and he works with the most vulnerable population out of the Anoka Regional Hospital and statewide. And so they have agreed and support this, the Department of Human Services as well. And so this would allow others to work in, at the Department of Human Services as a blanket statement as well.
Yeah. Representing.
Yeah, I wasn't specifically saying work at DHS. Yep. DHS has a long list of licensees, certifications, and other types of positions that they restrict people from working in. And my question was related to the long list of, and I forget how many different positions there are, but there are tens and hundreds, I believe. Would it be a blanket exemption from all of those?
Madam Chair, so it wouldn't be a blanket exemption. This is just one more way to prove rehabilitation. The final decision still comes down to the employer, and it would be a case-by-case situation.
Representative Cohn.
Well, I just, all of this talk about the problems of people who are convicted of underage drinking and the problems that leads to them later in life, I hope means there's going to be lots of support for my bill to lower the drinking age and to allow more opportunities for people under 21 to legally drink under supervision in a controlled circumstance.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you. I feel like
I wasn't putting it as an amendment.
Thank you, Representative Hahn.
Madam Chair, I feel like we've somewhat tuned in after a commercial for another bill on another day here. I just want to make one quick comment. If there was ever any doubt in your mind on our vote yesterday to lay over the $200,000 for de-escalation in veterans issues, this story puts the exclamation point on it.
And, Madam Chair, there's also a handout here from the MSBA in support of the bill, too. Everybody should have that.
Representative Crisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. Is it Ms. Matta Castillo?
Yes.
Wow, I got that right. Thank you for the story. That was fantastic. And to your point, Representative Khanna, after being down here, I'd actually like to raise the drinking age.
Well, Madam Chair, just since there's a specific reference to me, I want to point out that I pride myself on having the wettest voting record combined with the driest lifestyle of any legislator around.
Touche. Thank you. And so back to my original question. Because I just don't know, and I want to make sure I get the intent right, we've heard a couple of bills in other committees, and I just want to ask, so if I'm way off, just tell me, but would this also be a blanket situation for some of those more sensitive crimes, those dealing with children or in a sexual nature, so this doesn't apply at all?
No.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Matta Castillo.
Representative Crusha, so if there is a sexual offense in nature, first of all, they're not going to join the military. They will not be allowed in. Second of all, they will not get an honorable discharge for a crime of that nature. And so it's a moot point.
Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to talk about the language in Section C on starting on line 2.12. I noticed that you, and this has to do with when the DD 214 ceases to qualify as competent evidence, mm-hmm. and the bill as written here says it ceases to qualify for any felony crime committed by the person subsequent to the honorable discharge.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder why it just doesn't say crime. Do we? I'm envisioning a situation where someone is honorably discharged. Am I missing something here? Can you describe why felony? Why you drew the line there?
Madam Chair,
Representative Dentmer.
We could good point. What we could do is just eliminate the word felony and just say any crime committed by a person subsequent to the effective date of the honorable discharge. That would probably be more appropriate.
Mistake. Representative?
Yeah, just a mistake.
Hmm?
Yeah. Just
you know?
Yeah. Representative Bean.
That's after the point.
Madam Chair and Representative Simon and Representative Detmer, I would caution against that because even a misdemeanor crime is a crime, and these are things that may not exempt a person. And if now all of a sudden they're losing the ability to use their DD 214 as the certificate, they would lose that opportunity. So I would be cautious how we move forward in just striking the word felon and retaining the word crime.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative, again, this is would be a crime after the DD 214. So
it should be any crime.
It should be any crime.
Representative Simon.
Well, I support the bill. Otherwise, so I don't want to do harm to the bill. It didn't seem consistent with your intent. Right. So,
Madam Chair, and Representative, that was a good point. Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Cleary.
Madam Chair, without wanting to be substantively involved here, may I suggest that one could simply amend line 2.16 by before felony, inserting gross misdemeanor or felony crime.
Madam Chair,
Ms. Madden Castillo, yes.
Mr. Cleary, I think actually that was just an error when I look at it. So it's talking about after, if any crime is committed after the DD 214, the DD 214 no longer works. Well. So. You know, if someone's left the military and now they're committing crimes, they can't fall back on their previous life. Whereas we're saying the bill, the intent was that the DD 214 shows rehabilitation.
Yeah.
Littering.
Representative Freiberg.
Yeah, I would be in agreement with Mr. Cleary's suggestion, actually, because of what Representative Dean said. A misdemeanor is considered a crime, so that would include things like speeding.
Okay.
And I don't think, I mean, my sense of this is it's not the intent of something like that that can happen to anybody,
right.
Would disqualify subsequently, okay. Make the form not valid. A gross misdemeanor, on the other hand, I think is a more serious crime that, at least as I understand the intent of this, would maybe meet that standard.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Representative Detmer.
Madam Chair, so Mr. Cleary, language that you suggest?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Detmer moves to amend House File 88, I believe is what you're suggesting here. House File 88, page 2, line 16, before felony, insert gross misdemeanor or... And the effect of that would be, as was just pointed out, that a serious crime would change the would nullify the presumptive rehabilitation, but not a misdemeanor crime, which some speeding it could be. Some speeding crimes could be.
Representative Simon.
Well, I'll defer to the author on this, whatever he wants to do. It's just my sense is that this whole section of language speaks to, as Ms. Mesta Castillo was getting at, anything done after the honorable discharge. So, you know, I'll defer to the author on this. It just didn't seem consistent with your intent to qualify it with anything. I understand the bit about a misdemeanor, but even a misdemeanor, should someone have the ability to say, I was honorably discharged, then I committed a misdemeanor, and now here I'm showing you my DD 214 from years ago as a way to get me out of the misdemeanor. I don't think that's what you meant.
Right.
Yeah. Madam Chair, that is what as an author I met, and also my witness testifier that brought it to my attention too, is that anything that done after the honorable discharge. You wouldn't be able to use your DD 214 to show rehabilitation. That's just my opinion. I would like to just eliminate the word felony, and then we have a bill that I think should go forward.
Representative Simon.
I defer to the author.
Well, Representative Kahn?
I mean, I really, really think you don't want to, as someone who's gotten two or three totally unjust traffic offenses, which I'm sure were misdemeanors. Fortunately, I don't need to do any of this. But I really think it's very easy for somebody to get a traffic ticket of some kind, which they don't get to, which they can't prove they didn't do.
Madam Chair and Representative and committee, the whole purpose of this is not to give anybody a heads up or advantage to getting a job. It's just that if you're going to be honorably discharged from the military, fine, you can use your DD-214 when applying for work for a job, but it would only apply for that time where you're in the military, and it does not. It would be nulled if you commit crimes afterwards.
Representative Detmer, what is your motion?
Madam Chair, my motion is that this is passed and then sent to the General Register. House File 88.
Okay.
Pardon? I'm sorry, the amendment.
We haven't done the amendment.
Strike on line 2.16, just strike the word felony.
Is there any further discussion? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And I guess playing off what Representative Kahn said, I guess I would be more comfortable with the language that Mr. Cleary suggested because, as was stated here, traffic tickets are considered a misdemeanor, petty misdemeanor. That would be considered a crime. Littering. I'm thinking of the old song, Alice's Restaurant, where he was arrested for littering.
Cigarette butts.
Yeah, anything. So I mean, just I think I understand what you're trying to get at. A gross misdemeanor or a felony are major crimes, but if somebody's arrested for littering or arrested for a speeding ticket, I think we're and then not allow them to be able to say I've been rehabilitated because of that. I think is more than you want to do. I mean, and that's just my suggestion.
No, you don't get out.
Representative Simon.
Madam Chair, I think the issue here isn't so much the level of crime; it's the timeline.
Right.
It's that no matter what the crime, from littering to murder, no one should be able to say, here's my DD-214 from 10 years ago. I think that's the issue. It's not the level of crime, right. I believe, as I'm reading this. So I support the Detmer.
And Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Simon. And people, when they apply for a job, they don't have to use their DD-214.
All in favor of the Detmer Amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. Representative Detmer renews his motion to that House File 88 be recommended, passed, and sent to General Register as amended. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. We have to finish a critical bill, House File 903. We have to put an amendment on it. We have to get this done before anyone leaves this room. In order for
what?
Mr. Gallucci to go to Washington on April 15th and be first in line or something like that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No pressure.
Otherwise, we were going to have veterans' homes studied this summer along with veterans' cemeteries as part of our interim work. But we seem to be in a time frame for House File 903. So Representative Purcell moves that House File 903 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And Representative Purcell would like to move the adoption of 903A2 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, to the, I'm going to speak to the amendment here because the amendment makes the bill quite a bit shorter. As you see on line 6, line six, we're gonna insert may as and delete shall, and then lines 9 through 15 are deleted. That's the amendment.
All in favor of the Purcell amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Mr. Gallucci.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, ma'am.
Do you want to make any comments about the bill as amended?
I simply would urge the committee to approve this, and I want to stress clearly that MDVA is very sensitive to the fact that there are a number of communities looking for homes. And what I want to say to anybody and everybody, I guess, is that this language is a requirement of the VA funding grant capital. It has nothing, it ties nobody's hands to the process, the governor, nor the legislature. It's simply seeking
authorization,
allowing them to go ahead and seek federal funding, and it would be required for any of the communities that are seeking and asking for a home in order to get on the capital project list for the Veterans Administration.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, I don't think I can explain it any better. I'm confident I can't. We're simply seeking that authorization through this bill.
Mr. Cleary.
Madam Chair and Representative Purcell, may I just suggest a technical amendment to the title on line 1.2 to delete establishing and insert authorizing?
I certainly would take that as a friendly amendment here. Do we have that, Madam Chair?
Representative Purcell moves to delete the word establishing and insert the word authorizing. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Representative Purcell moves adoption of the amendment A2. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any further discussion? Representative Purcell moves that House File 903 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means as the 903 as amended. Be recommended to pass and be referred to Ways and Means. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
And Purcell, go on your way.
Members, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Newton.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the minutes for March 11th and March 6th. I think that's all.
Fourth.
And March 4th as well. Thank you.
Representative Purcell moves adoption of the amendments or the minutes from March 4th, 6th, and
11th.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Any other business today? This meeting is adjourned. Thanks.